Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
The answer is 9 books and over 250 columns and commentaries. The question is, what has our guest Bill Schubart written? Quite a remarkable individual, quite a prolific creator, and an important voice of reason amidst too much chaos. We've heard from a diverse and extraordinarily talented group of people over the young life of this podcast, and what keeps being articulated in so many ways are ideas that, if codified, formalized, operationalized, will have a real impact. In fact, the very process of turning ideas that matter into actions and policies that matter is what true leadership is all about. And that's what we will talk about today with our guest, Bill Schubart.
This is going to be a great conversation and tie together the conversations we've had with our past guests who've held leadership roles in our state and their communities. And I'm super excited, David, to talk with you and with Bill about how we can move individuals, public organizations, and nonprofit leaders together to start addressing some of our communal challenges and to create policies that aren't just band-aids for what we need to fix in this moment, but that start to change the trajectory of how we address problems in the future. So, David, I know you have vast experience working in all of these arenas, as does Bill, who has so many connections to so many Vermonters. And I am sure that this is going to be a rich conversation. And I'm excited to hear the creative ideas that we come up with as we look at challenges in education, healthcare, and how we build allegiances with unexpected allies.
Bill is an author, a historian, an entrepreneur, a Vermonter, and a friend, and a keen observer about so much related to Vermont's and our nation's past, present, and future, and about the leadership required to get us where we all need to go. You should read about him, and I encourage you to read about his work and his life at Schubart.com. And now let's get into the conversation with him. Bill, thank you again so very much for being on our podcast today. You're a visionary and an individual with profound historical insight. And our conversation today, Bill, will be both about looking backward and moving forward, which one has to do, I think, always simultaneously, as you and I have discussed. And our first question really is just about that. And it's the same question I have posed to our other guests. What has this past year taught you? What have you learned from this past unbelievable year that has been so painful, so damaging for so many, and clearly has changed our world so dramatically? What has it meant to you, and what lessons have you gleaned that will allow us to move forward?
Well, I think one of the areas that's been really fascinating to me is the impact on education. And it's very hard to, you know, to generalize about that, because when we talk about education, we're talking about everything from essential early education, you know, 2, 3, 4 year olds on up to postgraduate level. And, you know, what is the optimum relationship between time spent in a classroom with a wise professor, mentor, you know, having a discussion with colleagues, and how much of that can be done online? And I think there are really wonderful, wonderful lessons that we can take from this sort of enforced, you know, movement online that will actually improve both the strategic and the financial prospects for higher ed, which, as you know, is in pretty rough shape in many areas, and it's not just small institutions. Finding that balance between online and in situ, I think, is a tremendous opportunity, and I think colleges are just really now figuring it out. Healthcare, same thing. I mean, I have a very good friend who's a neurologist, and he said, you know, I'm doing a lot of telemedicine. And he said, you know, at first my patients were like, well, I really need to see you. And he said, that's kind of reversed itself over the last 16, 18 months. He said, people, do I have to really come to the hospital? You know, can't we do this online? I can take a picture of what's troubling me, or, you know. The good news is that we are discovering through this enforced use of new technology, new and more cost-efficient and probably even more effective ways of relating to one another as human beings.
And you know, Bill, that's a perfect segue into a conversation we'll have about leadership related not only to education, but the architecture you articulate, that digital new architecture, is quite profound relative to delivery of education, receipt of education. It also, of course, exacerbates and illustrates the true digital divide between those students and families and communities that are able to thrive in this medium you and I are using right now, and those families, communities, individuals who are not able to thrive for all sorts of reasons. And it really, I think you're exactly correct. We need to be able to utilize and marry the new and the old together, certainly within the context of education, because we know there is nothing like that human interaction between instructor slash teacher slash professor and a student. That individual human connection is absolutely not only invaluable, but irreplaceable. So as long as we are able to marry the best of both of these worlds and take into consideration those individuals who are unable to do what we're doing right now, we exactly, I think, may be able to take this as a lesson and move forward.
Well, when I get asked to talk about my own education, which was both in the Morrisville public school system and then Phillips Exeter and then colleges, it's interesting because I think back and I don't envisage pools or libraries or sports facilities. There are about 10 or 12 people whose faces come up vividly. And to be totally honest, they didn't give a damn about my self-esteem. They wanted to hold me accountable for learning. You know, they were scary. You know, they were not my best friends. They kept me on my toes. And so I think that the relationship between the professor and the learner is critical. The question is, what's the optimum channel mix between online? I remember doing a book event at the Bixby Library in Virgins. It was a cold winter night, and there were maybe 20 kids huddled on the front step, and they were from an institution in the back for, quote, troubled youth, and they were trying to get them into the vocational system and so on and so forth. And I said to the host when they let me in the back door, I said, why are all those kids gathered on the front? And they said, they don't have any Wi-Fi at their facility, and they're trying to do research on what careers might work for them. So some of them are here until 10 o'clock at night, just trying to be online. The thing that is shameful to me is that if we look back, when there was major technological revolution, like the arrival of electricity or the arrival of the telephone, we understood there needed to be a national effort. And, you know, it took a number of years, but it was understood that it was a national prerogative. There was the leadership that understood every home in America needed to be electrified. I mean, when the phones came, and I remember there were hill farms when I was a kid that still did not have electricity. Then the telephone came. And of course, our idea of a soap opera when we were a kid was to, if we were bored, is to just pick up the five-party line, put your hand over the receiver and listen. Oh my, ooh, ooh, she did, ooh, you know. And these were national initiatives. And something has happened in the country where we have decided now that the commercial incentive is so powerful that we need to do this wholly in the private sector. Now, admittedly, there's money coming in from the feds and so on to assist this, but there's no national understanding that broadband is really, you know, like the phone, like electricity. It's an imperative for progress and equality. And so we're still doing the best we can. You wire up this, you wire up that. And those of privilege, you know, have fiber optics coming into the home. And those who need broadband the most, whether it's telemedicine or education or, you know, I mean, try and interact with the Social Security and, you know, administration if you don't have broadband. You know, you can drive to Burlington and maybe get an appointment.
This bill is exactly what Meg and I were talking about prior to you coming on, and it relates to really the subject of this conversation. What do we do about it? And I know, Meg, you've had a lot of thoughts and conversation about leadership relative to how we change these realities. It's probably a great way to get into those questions.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm fascinated. I also had the soap opera in my house when I was growing up as a kid on a five-party line. And I think that, you know, this really touches me in how we're talking about it, because I think it goes to where I want to go with leadership and with this partisan divide that we have. And the thing about broadband and some of the other lessons we've learned from this pandemic is it's forced us to look at each other as humans and look at each other in a more comprehensive way. And I think that's giving us opportunities. And I know, Bill, that you have spoken and written about leadership. As a matter of fact, it's sort of the theme of almost everything you do, is looking at how to address different problems, different challenges, and what skills and approaches are needed. And one of your articles you wrote, "Life is complex, as are the issues we face. Fear and insecurity seek the comfort of black and white answers, whereas most durable solutions are intrinsically imperfect and lie in the complex middle ground." So I wanted to kind of take this conversation into leadership and ask you, what does leadership look like in Vermont right now? How do we take the black and white and complex and make it effective and productive to address the challenges that we're facing on a local, state, national level?
And it's a perfect follow-up to what you just articulated, Bill. Again, that divide between the real and the virtual and vis-a-vis education, what do we do about it? How do we make sure that we not only bridge this divide, but use the best of what makes us human to lead into the future?
I think the key thing is, and it's really interesting because we have a very manifest example of leadership that does not have the architecture behind it that leadership needs. And specifically, I give Governor Scott full credit for being the best crisis manager in the country, if not in the world. You know, I mean, he has done us a huge favor. He's saved a lot of lives. He understands crisis management. I'm not surprised. But strategic management is a wholly different thing. In other words, we have endemic problems that we've been living with for a long time, like hunger, affordable housing, access to health care, early essential education, child care, and I hate that term. You know, these have been with us for a long time. We have a one-year budget cycle. We have a two-year term of leadership. And we have absolutely no strategic planning in the state of Vermont. That's the architecture that has to be behind good strategic leadership. The reality is we govern this state over the stern of the ship. We're not looking over the bow. You know, a dead body comes by. Oh, we got to have a law. Some sewage comes by. Oh, we got to have a law. And, you know, I understand that. But there's so much information and so much intelligence that we do not harness in the service of leadership. Then, of course, you get into what is leadership. And this is difficult, because if you overlay politics, there's a compulsion to be liked by everybody, to have everybody sign off on every initiative, and not to take risk. And that is the antithesis of leadership. Leadership takes courage. It takes the capacity to listen, learn, be curious, to honor dissent, to create consensus, and then to act. And we have a tendency in Vermont not to really do anything significant until every last person has signed off on it. And that's left us with a lot of accelerating problems.
I mean, this is fascinating, Bill. So move into what you would do about it. What do we do to harness, and I love the way you articulated, harness leadership. Harness leadership, because it relates to how we are able to gather the best and the brightest, put the best and the brightest ideas and people into action and move forward. How do we do that?
Well, part of it is exactly what you're doing now, you and Meg. I mean, actually having conversations about what is leadership. I don't hear many of those conversations. I hear a whole lot of people who want to be leaders, and I don't hear them being pressed on what their idea of leadership is. So I think part of that is really understanding and defining leadership. The other piece of it is, which is really critical, is you've got to have that architecture, that, you know, that strategic planning architecture behind leadership. You know, as I said to the governor said, well, the last thing we need is, you know, another government agency. He said, we've got an affordability problem. I said, you've got 3,000 or 4,000 incredibly intelligent men and women in Vermont who think about Vermont, who care about Vermont. You could pick 9 of them. Give them a $500 a year honorarium. Give them an executive director. And for $300,000 or $400,000, you could have a strategic planning resource for the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. We don't have that. We haven't had that since Snelling.
Bill, that what you're talking about, for example, a DARPA for Vermont, not obviously related to defense, but a think tank, a RAND Corporation for Vermont, for all of the ideas and the people that could move us forward. That's an extraordinary idea. And so much of the good that has come into the United States and the minds from all of our families and grandparents and great-grandparents came through that focus, as you say, on strategic planning architecture. And that's why those think tanks were created, and that's why so much good came from them. I think that's quite important.
And to the issue of leadership, again, I have this conversation with young parents, like an old grandparent. You know, we're of course very judgmental about our children parenting. And the thing that occurs to me is I find too many young parents who are emotionally dependent on the adulation of their children. They don't understand the job description is to raise resilient, independent adults who will go out into the world, not children who will just love you and appreciate you forever. And that applies to leadership in the political spectrum. You know, if you're going to actually research, develop consensus, and make change, everybody's not going to love you. They're just not. I'm sorry. You know, you don't need 100%. You need 65 or 70 or 75%. And then you need to move ahead. And it's been done in Vermont's past. I mean, we've had, you know, Madeline Cunin pointed this out. She said the most progressive, you know, environmental legislation that's ever been produced in Vermont was produced by Republicans, you know?
And you see that time and again. And I think one of the pieces that's really sparking me in this conversation is thinking about the roles of businesses, the roles of nonprofits, the roles of outside of elected leaders in our community, and finding a space so that they can create the structure and and the momentum that's needed for politicians to do what they need to do then to make it into a law. And that, you know, our citizen legislature is fabulous, but that's what's missing, is sometimes the real skill set that comes from behind that. And I'm wondering, you know, Bill and also David being in this, if you can think of examples where the skills of public-private partnerships have come together to provide an infrastructure then for the government to address a problem, and what that looked like, how that could look in Vermont to address either broadband or healthcare or education or any problem.
Yeah. Well, we've seen it very powerfully in the whole issue of childcare. I mean, you know, the Vermont Business Roundtable, the Lake Champlain Chamber of Commerce, the Let's Grow Kids group, they, you know, in the nonprofit sector, they've all come together and they've said, look, you know, this is a absolute economic imperative. You know, 50 years ago, when a family could afford a reasonable home and food and education and access to healthcare on the compensation of a single parent, is a different issue. That's not true anymore. I mean, I know families where the husband and the wife, you know, are each holding one or two jobs to just maintain their housing and their food. So childcare becomes an imperative. We've seen this in Europe. Europe's way ahead of us, as they are in a number of things around the issue. And this is a digression, which I'll be very brief about. My problem is I struggle with the whole concept of childcare. To me, we need to redefine the public education system. And instead of closing schools in all the small towns and then building, you know, childcare facilities, we need to say public education starts either at birth or at 3 months and goes forward. And it's not child care storage, it's early essential education. But again, that's a digression.
Well, Bill, on that digression before you, I digress on your digression. When you talked about child care, on my note card here, I wrote child care and I crossed out the word care because I don't like that. We care, and Meg knows this, we care for our tomato plants. We don't do the same nurturing as we do for our children to make sure philosophically, psychologically, emotionally that they thrive. And that's what the scholastic infrastructure should be, to that extent is, should be about. So that digression, I think, that's not a digression, that's centrality.
Well, and all the science indicates in early childhood development that the incredibly significant learning starts within months of birth. You know, so if you have early educators supported by, you know, the pediatric community to be sure that children are well and are not exposed to adverse childhood experiences, they come to school willing and anxious to learn. Now we talk about a public education system. And of course, the same is true at the other end. I mean, so many of the people applying to community colleges, you know, it's a continuum for them of their education. What if we said public education starts at 3 months old, and by the way, the mother gets the first 3 months paid leave to bond with her child, starts at 3 months, and then has no ceiling. You can go to college when you're age 56, you know? I mean, now we're talking about a system and re-engineering it. But to me, that's the kind of thing, those are the kind of discussions that leaders ought to be driving.
And lifelong education that clearly, especially in this environment, very few people begin whatever it is that he or she will be doing, continue doing that for their entire life. They reinvent themselves over and over again. And that is no longer going to be the outlier. That is the norm. And that requires lifelong learning and education, not as an avocation, but as an absolute reality.
Look what's happening in the healthcare sector. We don't have enough nurses. We've got travelers coming in from all over the world that are paid a contract fee of something like $119 an hour because we don't have enough nurses. The UVM School of Medicine graduates 106 or 108 doctors a year. Why don't they graduate 200 doctors a year? You know, is it a guild structure that is trying to control that? But I mean, I'm sure you're following what's going on in the whole UVM system. People in obstetrics, pain management, there are four or five other clinics where you just cannot get into the hospital. And a lot of it's personnel.
Right. But Meg, I just wanted to follow up on a question you had asked. And Bill, you and I have talked about this in broad sense. But for example, in Vermont, the billboard ban. I think the billboard ban is a very good example of a group of relatively disparate people and opinions coming together to decide the best interest of Vermont, best interest of our environment and of our social fabric is to ban billboards. I think that, again, Meg, to your question, is a great historical example of what we can use as a leadership architecture moving forward.
And it goes to the one piece that got missed in this, which is the public-private piece. All of the things we're talking about are needed by businesses to make money. And I think too often we say nonprofits are good, businesses are bad. And the reality is they function with different goals in place and they both have strengths to share. So I do think as we move forward and we think about, you know, do we have a strategic think tank, like providing space so business leaders can say, this is how you hold something accountable and you measure success. And nonprofit leaders can say, this is how you don't just look at the bottom line. You look at the full spectrum of somebody's life and what it's going to cost us over a long period of time. And we get the best of the best bringing their strengths together for the good of our state and to advise our political leaders and to help move us forward. And, you know, what business is going to say we don't want billboards? Everybody knows billboards drive traffic. But if more people come to Vermont, because there's no billboards, there's a win-win there. So I just think we sometimes put everything in that black and white, good or bad. And through that, we lose the opportunity to find the best for all of us as we come out of this.
I think that's so true, Meg. I mean, I see that all the time. The columns that I write for Vermont Digger sometimes elicit 50 or 100 emails. And so often they're, you're wrong or you're right. You know what I mean? There's no understanding that there is a discussion to be had in the middle. The one thing in all the stuff that I look at carefully that is so clear to me, Vermont has a budget. We've passed a budget of $7.3 billion. You add in the federal 2.8 or whatever it is, and you're looking at, let's say, $9 billion or $10 billion. That comes down to $11,000 for each Vermonter, $44,000 for each home. And everybody is talking about, we need more money. We need more money. We need more money. And the reality is, money often confuses real solutions. It doesn't always solve the problem. It can often make the problem worse. And if we had a robust discussion about changing our investments from remediation to prevention, you can have that discussion in healthcare. If we were teaching kids how to lead healthy lives sexually, nutritionally, every way, we would have less expense in special ed and the criminal justice system and in corrections. The example that I give is I actually at one point got a couple of college presidents in the state college system to meet with corrections and the chancellor, Jeb Spaulding, then, to talk about taking a cohort of 25 nonviolent women in the women's prison in South Burlington. Those women cost $90,000 per woman per year, and they have very little opportunity for reentry. Take a cohort of 25 of those and put them into Johnson or Linden. You know, give them $20,000 to live on so they don't, you know, have to go back to their drug-addicted boyfriend. You know, give the college 100% of the tuition, spend $5,000 on drug testing and administration, you've saved $40,000 per woman, and you've created a pathway to reentry. And frankly, if 10 or 15 of those women found their way back into society, what a savings that would be. And it's true everywhere. It's true in one care. You know, as one hospital person told me, he said, I am totally dependent on a steady stream of sick people. I fix them. I bill transactionally. I fight for a couple of months with the insurance company about how many cents on the dollar I'm going to get. That's all expensive. If we could make our investment in population health, move it upstream, the downstream remediation cost would be so much less. And I mean, it's just, there are examples of it everywhere.
Well, just the generational impact of any one of these successes. I mean, that's what's frustrating to me as someone that looks at numbers, is that people, as you started with the budget, people only look at this moment in time, and they don't look at, if we are successful with that mother, what does that mean for her children over the next generation, over them not ending up in prison, in corrections, without education, with a substance abuse disorder. So I strive to find the systems, and I think we're talking about them, that can start people's lens going from right now profit on loss on paper to, as you said, looking at the long-term investment and how that will come back pretty quickly. And now with these funds that we have, is a great time to take that step back and say, let's use these now for the future, as opposed to now and they're gone and we have the same exact challenge in front of us in 2 years.
And you see, Bill, that you are you're sparking in both of us conversations that could last for a very long time. But this last example is exactly the kind of strategic leadership architecture that we have been discussing. We essentially, as we should be, figure out what outcomes we want. Outcomes relative to a reduction of recidivism. Outcomes relative to educational attainment. Outcomes relative to economic attainment, social interaction, and then lead toward those outcomes, as opposed to what we very much, as a society, seem to do now, deal with those immediate crises we see in front of us and not lead toward the outcomes that we need and deserve and that obviously will move us forward.
That's exactly right.
Such a wonderful way to spark this conversation, Bill, and so eloquently put, as you do in writing, in words, and then not only say it, but just give us that clear example of, I loved that example of the woman in the women's prison and what it could mean for our state colleges and what it could mean in terms of state savings for us taxpayers. So grateful that you took some time to kind of think with us and provide us with that historical look. And also, it's not rocket science. Like, it's here if we just take a moment to really think about what our goals are and what we're trying to achieve.
We're deeply grateful, Bill, for your insights now and obviously what you write regularly. So I thank you very much. I know this is the beginning of what I hope will be many conversations like this, but we're very grateful for what you do on a daily basis. So thank you.
Well, the feeling is mutual. I mean, the fact that you're out there sparking these conversations, not just with me, but with other people, I think is so vital to how we begin to change the mindset and see the future of Vermont in a different lens. So thank you.
What a stimulating discussion on the roles of leaders and what makes a person an effective leader. One of the things that really struck me that I noticed from Bill, and I noticed, David, that you do and we're trying to do with this show, is to really show that leaders are the people in the background often, that present the ideas, that plant the space, that provide opportunity for conversations. And I love that about our podcast and about Bill's approach and about your approach to leadership, that belief about what is possible, how we treat each other and the space that we create. So really powerful to me. I'm wondering, David, what did you take away about leadership and how we're going to grow Vermont's leadership potential?
You're absolutely right, Meg. It was such a rich conversation. I know you do as well. We talk about and try to embody the concept of servant leadership. And so maybe the best way to answer that is to start with actually one of my favorite quotes on leadership. And the quote is that I start with the premise that the function of leadership is to produce more leaders, not more followers. Vermont, clearly within that, the spirit of that quote, Vermont should be a state of innovation, certainly related to agriculture, but also sustainable development and sustainable tourism. And leadership is the practice of motivating and instilling confidence and charting a course. Business leadership, civic leadership, political leadership, Meg, it's all sacred. And the job of a leader, as Bill articulated and as we've discussed, is to create infrastructures that help motivate and inspire toward a set of goals or public goods. And I love the way Bill talked about harnessing leadership. Bill's suggestions for ways to harness leadership are spot on.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. I know you did, David, and it has really sparked thoughts in me. Hopefully that's happened with you too. If you're enjoying our Bold Ideas podcast, if you like this conversation, please let us know. You can give us a rating, and you can also leave comments for us, and that will help us make the show connect to you more. And please subscribe to the show wherever you're listening now, or hit follow on Spotify so you won't miss an opportunity to think boldly with us.
Thank you again, Meg, as always. And thanks to our guest, Bill Schubart, and thanks to you all. And please remember to think bold, and let's all continue leading toward freedom and unity. We look forward to next time.